everyone, and welcome back to the Research VR podcast. I am your host, Osbal Abanyan, and this is the podcast behind the science and design of virtual reality. With me today are two special guests, Robin Statham and Colin Northway, the two co-founders of the Museum of Other Realities, which is an unreleased virtual reality art gallery, which we will talk a lot about. Hello, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey.
Hey, hey, hey. And of course, our usual co-host, Peter Luckoff.
Yeah, hello. I'm basically for the first time in here, so my mind is a little bit blown. Don't mind me being a little bit blown away.
Yes, this is actually us meeting in the Museum of Other Realities, which is a social VR experience, an actual art gallery, which you can go. It is not publicly released. This is still a branch that you've, you know, let your friends and family into. But this is a really interesting first time for us to be doing a podcast in, one of the only few times we've done a podcast in another social VR app. We're not our usual avatars, that's for sure.
No, you look like a green... Oh, no, you know how you look like? You look like this thingy that is about above the head of Sims, kind of. You know, this green, weird thingy.
The symbol on top of the Sims?
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Colin and Robin, you guys, I mean, tell us a little bit about yourselves. Tell us a little bit about the more. We'll go into a little bit of your backgrounds and how we ended up to this point. But let's start from the beginning.
Well, the museum was originally started by Colin.
No. Let's start with you. Who is Robin?
Oh, okay. Robin. Well, I was a child. No. So I was an industrial designer before I got into VR, and I picked up a headset while I was working at a consultancy in town here and started messing around and got more and more into interaction and experience design for virtual reality.
And what is exactly an industrial designer? What sort of
design? Oh, so I designed like physical objects, consumer electronics, wearables, kind of stuff like the Fitbit. I designed a robot at one point that like sorts things in warehouses.
Whoa, cool.
A bunch of different stuff, mostly physical stuff. But I noticed that the really interesting questions, especially as form factors started to diminish and kind of disappear, and more objects disappeared into one object, namely like a cell phone. It was more how you use the device and how you talk to it and how it talks to you that interested me. So I got more and more into the digital side of it. And then when I jumped into VR, I kind of saw a place where my appreciation for 3D work and 3D form finding and problem solving had a real application in interaction design and user experience design, because there's a lot of interesting unsolved problems in this arena. So that's how I got into this, more or less.
Nice. And Colin?
My name's Colin Northway. My wife, Sarah, and I have been making indie games for the last 10 years about. So we're very, very from games. And then we kind of jumped early on the VR train. So we launched a game called Fantastic Contraption that was a launch title on the HTC Vive, which was obviously super exciting for us. And then after Contraption came out, I got super excited about this like kind of strange art stuff more than games. I mean, I'm still like deeply into games, but you know, like Kabibo, Isaac Cohen stuff, and people doing these kind of like and strange art projects like Sean Tan stuff as well, and kind of all the stuff people started doing at Tilbrush. And I was like, oh shit, this is so cool. But you know, I want to play more of this stuff. I want to get access to more of this stuff, but it's such a pain in the ass to, you know, like Isaac Kabibo has all of these experiments on his website, but he's got like a list of 20, and anyone can go on there and download one and give it a try. And there's like crazy cool shit in there. But there's this problem of like, even if, you know, somebody tweets something cool, it's like, oh, that looks dope. But it's probably kind of a 2-minute experience, 5-minute experience. And the pain in the ass of like clicking the link, finding the download, installing it, putting it on my, you know, putting on my headset and getting it running and everything is so much friction
right.
that it's kind of unlikely that, you know, even I am super into this stuff, I'm going to like actually drop into a lot of it. So I was like, well, you know, we just need to like get this stuff all in like one place. So that's how the gallery was started. The idea is like people are doing fucking cool ass shit in VR. It's just we need a place to actually see it.
Right. And it sounds like it almost came out of necessity from you trying to solve your own problem, which is how do I experience these things that I keep seeing on my Twitter feed in an easier and more cohesive way.
Yeah, exactly.
And Robin, I mean, what in terms of VR and VR art, where did you see yourself coming in to this? Or were you also like coming from the same Twitter sphere side of things and seeing some of the work and that was posted up there and you wanted to experience it?
Honestly, I didn't roll that deep in the tweets before I started working on this project. It just so happens that there's a great VR community on Twitter. So now I'm on there a fair bit. But in the beginning, and I think still at its core, the gallery to me represents, I mean, VR in general to me represents a new way to interact with information and one another. And the gallery is kind of the ideal medium for me to experiment with that sort of, I mean, there's a whole lot of different types of art, different types of information, and different types of gestures and possibilities for communication between people. This is kind of a sandbox to explore that. And I've got the chance to work with Colin, who's a very talented developer and skilled in a lot of ways that I'm not. So we've been having a lot of fun.
So how did it all start? So what was the initial kickoff and how many, you know, different art pieces do you have already?
The start goes way back that even when we were working on Contraption, I like tried to start this, but without actually having to do any work. I was like, oh, we'll start like a co-op and, you know, we'll all kind of like chip in and we'll make this space. And I like contacted a bunch of people and tried to get people interested in it because I didn't have time and it kind of went nowhere, unfortunately. So after Contraption ended, and then the original idea was actually more like a bundled of games kind of idea. So we would take stuff like Blarp and Chroma Lab, kind of small things, and then bundle them into one thing and then release them monthly. And as part of that, we started with like a kind of a foyer that you would see before you went into this like kind of like bundle of games inside VR. You'd like walk through kind of an art gallery space. And then Max Weisel, who's working on the Normal API, which is a multiplayer API for VR, he got in touch and he was like, oh, you know what you should do? You should spend 2 minutes and drop Normal into this. And then we can have like a get together inside the gallery space and we'll see what that's like. And I was like, all right, I mean, we're definitely not going to do multiplayer because it's a huge amount of work to do multiplayer. But like, it's a, you know, fun experiment. It'll take 2 minutes. So let's try it. And so we like had this really bare bones gallery space. It had like a Blort from Kevin Mack in it. And Danny Bittman did corner vision for it. And then we had a couple Tilt Brush pieces from my wife Sarah, and then that was pretty much it. We just put that up on Dropbox, built that up on Dropbox, and then on Twitter, I was like, "Hey, we're like VR party. If anybody wants to come check it out, you know, just download the executable and hop in. We'll be like doing it for the next 2 hours." And then I don't know, like a couple, like 20 or 30 people came in, and it was just like amazing. It was like super fun. We were hanging out with all these people that, you know, I talked to on Twitter, but not in real life, or, you know, got to see in real life, but only at conferences and stuff. And from there, the multiplayer gallery just like totally overwhelmed the kind of like bundle idea.
Wow. That's so fascinating that that entire multiplayer aspect came from a suggestion, right? And it wasn't even part of the initial vision of how this was going to work out.
I mean, I strongly believe that that's where good design comes from, that especially when you're on the cutting edge, when you're working in fields that nobody really understands, and people still don't really understand VR, myself included. And so when you're on the cutting edge like that, you want to just be trying stuff. Maybe it seems like a good idea, maybe it seems like a bad idea, but if it has potential to be interesting, you should just be experimenting. And then the good stuff comes from, you know, can come from unlikely tangents. It can come from somebody has this like suggestion and you don't think it's a good idea, but you try it and it turns out to like totally change your conception of what the medium is possible, you know, what is good in the medium and what it's capable of doing.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of the iterative things that you guys have added in here has been from accidental discoveries. Maybe Robin, you can talk a little bit about that. It sounds like you work more on the design aspects of this, the interaction design, the experience design. Yeah, I mean, what are the certain things that, what are certain assumptions that you had made that proved themselves to be true or otherwise?
Well, I think first of all, I would have to say that I didn't make a lot of this. We're very fortunate to work with a lot of talented artists. And those artists have helped to spark a lot of creative gestures, which we've then carried to the rest of the gallery. I mean, I think that technology at its core, there's a lot of strength in connecting people. And basically everything we do is just connecting people in a new way, in a shared experience that is hopefully amazing. And what we do to make those experiences amazing is like, I didn't create the mountains over there, but what we do is we change the way that you can jump into those mountains and run around and explore them. And I don't want to say consume, because that sounds very
experience, I guess, right?
Capitalist experience. Yeah. So we're just looking for not the best possible way, but exciting ways of experiencing these wonderful fountains of creativity that are coming from all over the world and sharing those experiences with as many people as possible in a way that they can relate to and enjoy.
Now, maybe for the average audience listener who has never been here, could you quickly describe what this place kind of consists of? So I guess there are a lot of multiple art pieces from different artists, and you're going to launch it one day for everyone, or it's going to be this closed place? And
actually, how is it? Let's clarify. Also, I want to clarify that art pieces aren't framed paintings on a wall, right? Like, I think we've seen that in VR. We've seen literal recreations of museums in VR. How would you describe this museum?
This is a collection of pieces of art done natively in virtual reality and best experienced in virtual reality. A lot of them are spatial or based on, they're generative. They're based on, you know, particle simulations. Being with other people changes the way that you experience them, because those other people affect the experience in a way that is more than just social, but can also, you know, affect the visuals or the environment. I think that we've kind of been looking through windows into scenes for a long, long time, and everyone pretty much understands that. But there's a huge opportunity, you know, now that you're in the piece effectively, to see things in a whole new way. So, you know, you're just exploring a new way of seeing, I guess.
Yeah, it looks like, when you walk into it, it looks like a lot like a traditional art gallery. So it's white walls. It's like the gallery space itself is really simple. But then the pieces inside it are, you know, don't have to follow any of those rules, aren't simple, go do crazy things. So the art gallery kind of centers you, all the craziness that's going to happen as you walk around it. So yeah, as you say, we don't have many paintings on walls. A lot of it is kind of interactive or sculptural. There's a really wide variety of work. So we're right now standing in a room dedicated to Danny Bittman, who works a lot in Tilbrush. There's a lot of amazing Tilbrush sculptures in here. Behind me is like a giant kind of praying mantis creature who towers like 10 meters in the air. And then there's
standing underneath them.
Yeah, psychedelic crab is over there, which is a kind of like this alien crab with like tons of colors and like kind of like wavy protuberances coming off it. And then behind that on the other side of the room is what's it called? Snow?
Night Snow.
Night Snow.
I think we just called it Night Snow, honestly, or that's like the name of the actual file. I don't think Danny has a name for it. It was just one of his studies of snow that he did. He gave us like six, and we actually have two, one there and one there.
Yeah.
And so Night Snow is, yeah, Night Snow is like a favorite from a lot of people. So if you were to walk over to Night Snow, it would kind of look like a diorama maybe of like a night scene. It's got some trees and it's got a campfire, kind of an abstract campfire in the middle. But you can go down inside it. So if you jump down inside of Night Snow, then you become kind of the size of a camper around this campfire. All the trees get huge around you. And then we actually block out the rest of the gallery visually. So all you see is just a night sky around you. And one of the reasons it's so popular is because it's just a nice hangout spot. So there's other pieces in the gallery that are more kind of like explosive or in your face. But Night Snow becomes this, you know, you go in with a few friends and you just like crack open a beer, sit around the, this nice campfire. You know, your friends might be in like Berlin or Tokyo or other cities far away from you, but in this piece, you get to like sit down in this super pleasant Danny Bittman world and just like, you know, have a conversation with each other.
Yeah, I think that's probably a big part of what I've experienced in the Moor is that it end a lot of these pieces, whether they're interactive or not, end up becoming very much the conversation spots for you to hang out with people, and especially the interactive ones. Perhaps we can go to later on where you're kind of just sitting around and fiddling with the physics of a piece, and you just sit there for a good 20 to 30 minutes and talk. Is that something that perhaps you had designed around, or was that a happy coincidence that happened?
Yeah, that's all happy coincidence. You know, as I say, I was trying to avoid doing any multiplayer thing. And then as soon as we did it, I'm surprised how rich the multiplayer, how many ways multiplayer enhances the experience. So obviously, it's nice just being in a gallery, talking to your friends. You get to catch up. So there's kind of a peer social experience that's nice. But also, so if you look over there, we can't quite see it from where we're standing now. But Nick Ladd has done a series of dinosaurs. There's these big dinosaurs. And you can get on the back of the dinosaurs. So if you're on your own and you're going through the gallery, you kind of see these dinosaurs and you're like, oh, that's some cool dinosaurs. Maybe you take, you know, you look around a little bit and you see what's in the next room. But if you're in with a group of friends, it's really common to jump up on the back of a dinosaur and then suddenly you're like, oh, I'm riding the dinosaur. And you're like, you know, you put your hands in the air and like, it's a role, like kind of a role playing moment.
Right.
And so actually it's, working on the Moor has really changed my ideas of what the word interactive means. So, you know, especially being from games, my idea definition of interactive would be, well, you can pull it, you can push it, you can throw it. That's what an interactive thing is. I wouldn't usually think of like sculpture, non-moving sculpture, as being interactive. But as soon as you add other people, the way that they play with it and play with each other and converse with each other is that makes these kind of like quotes non-interactive things deeply interactive pieces.
But as far as I understand and as far as I perceive, there are more factors to our sensations right now in this museum than just the art pieces. So, for example, the audio that I hear from you, we won't hear it on the podcast itself, but your audio is basically being slightly distorted in an echoish way. So I kind of think that we are literally in a museum. And there's also this background noise, very subtle, like nearly white noise that somehow creates this feeling of big space, right? And also the locomotion system, where we can float around and teleport, but also not really move, but more like this floating. I guess it all adds together to the experience, right?
Audio is an incredibly important part of VR. I think it's an important part of 2D games, but in VR, it's like squared in its importance. And so we would work with a really good audio team, Michelle in the Pit, who they worked with us in Fantastic Contraption. So, you know, they've got as much experience doing VR audio as pretty much anybody does at this point. And so M. Halberstadt, who is a shell in the pit, she does a lot of our audio design. She also has a piece in the gallery that is amazing called Memory. Oh, no, what's it called? It's not Memory Helmet. It's
It is Memory
Is Helmet. It Memory Helmet? It's called Memory Helmet. Sorry. Yeah, so they do all this amazing work that adds tremendously. And it's more than you might think. I think you have to like really experience a thing with and without it. A lot of the time, you know, you wouldn't notice the room tone that you're mentioning or necessarily the like slight reverb on the voices that give it that sense of space. So I think it's in some ways subtle because it's all subconscious and it just makes that kind of back of your brain believe it. It makes it feel like a real place, like you're really there, like it really sinks you into a location.
It's like the salt for the whole experience. You can taste it. You've probably used too much, but you need it in a lot of foods, you know?
Ooh, that's a nice one. I haven't heard that term before for design. I like that.
Well, I'm a terrible cook, and my partner's a great cook, so
he just downs the salt on top.
Yeah, exactly. I'm learning.
Taste it.
How does it work technologically that you have so much beautiful, great art? And I know that it's usually, even for one art piece, not that easy to make it run in VR smoothly. But here, literally, we are surrounded by many, many, many those art installations.
How many pieces are there as well? As of today,
we have over 100. I guess we're probably looking at like 105 or 110 pieces in the gallery by about 25 artists. So there's a lot in the gallery to look at. There's a lot to explore. And about how many rooms are there? There's like,
oh man, there's like 13 on the bottom floor, and there will be 14 on the top floor.
Wow. Right. And now we've filled up like four on the top floor, five.
Yeah.
Like four or five.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got a few extra there so we can do some month-to-month stuff if we want.
And how do you optimize the models or the art installations or the art installation models you're getting? Or
yeah, so obviously performance is a challenge for us. We unload stuff if it's outside of line of sight. So the gallery is, obviously your listeners can't see it, but it's kind of a series of rooms with really big doors between them. And so Robin did all the architectural design. It's not straight walls. It's kind of a nice, how would you describe the look of it, Robin?
Hexagon?
It is a three-dimensional Voronoi pattern.
Whoa.
Which I then do some jazzing up to in, I guess you could call it post in a weird way, 3D post. I don't know if that's a thing, but yeah. And then we bring it in here. It's like, but we like using the noise, or I like using the noise, because I find that when you try and directly author a pattern like this, it just comes off as arbitrary. Whereas if you set up the conditions for the pattern to be generated, then you can get some really beautiful and slightly unanticipated results, which you then craft to your needs. And I think that's a lot of why we find natural spectacles really beautiful. It's because of those. I mean, to everyone else, the conditions that set up this pattern are hidden, right? So it's that underlying knowledge of these hidden conditions that create these wonderful shapes, sort of opposing forces that we can't see. And a lot of the architecture here is based on those hidden underlying conditions that give it this consideration that isn't mine necessarily. So it doesn't come off as arbitrary. It might also be that I just find it's easy to dislike things that you've done. So I didn't do this directly.
You know,
so
you can also,
I can like it a little more.
You can also put AI generated procedural environments on the box too.
I like to think of it as kind of a series of canyons that we found and then like cut some holes into, so it's more of a place we discovered than a place we built. The nice thing about the resulting pattern is that we can control line of sight using those kind of like cells. It's kind of like cells of a beehive, you can think of them. By controlling line of sight, we can control how much art we have to show at one time. And then when you start getting outside of sight lines, we'll hide it and then we'll unload it all, because you can't fit the entire gallery in your graphics card. You can't draw it all at once. And then you're absolutely right that sometimes one individual piece will just like blow out a graphics card. So we'll just have to work with artists to try to get things into a performance level that we can handle. Oz knows all about that, since that we had a lengthy period of time getting Oz's. We have a whole room dedicated to Oz's photogrammetry, and it took a while to get that to the point where we could run it in the gallery alongside Danny Bittman's room.
Yep, both pretty complicated in terms of polygons and lots to see. So yeah, I think the archways of each door kind of determine what you can see, right, and how much culling you can do to each room.
Right, yeah. And then we also have this idea of portals. So over there, kind of across the room from us, is spinning. It's like a hula hoop the size of a, it's like a, I don't know, 2.5 meter tall hula hoop. But instead of being able to see through it, on the other side of it is a space scene with a spaceship and some asteroids done by Liz Edwards. So since we're far away, we can't really see through the hula hoop. It's covered by this kind of like fog. And as we get closer, the fog will go away and then be replaced with the scene of the spaceship. So if something's really heavy, we can kind of hide it behind a portal. So that way we don't have to draw Liz's spaceship right now. We don't have to do it until we get closer. And by the time we get over to that corner, we'll have been able to hide, you know, the stuff in that other room because we can't see the doorway from there.
I didn't realize actually the portal was a optimization trick. I thought it was just a really cool way of going into a new place without having to, let's just say, you know, pressing a button and teleporting or whatnot. It's you can float into these portals. And it's a seamless transition from like a room with gravity to a room without, and same way you can go back out.
I guess that's the beauty of this place right now that I perceive that basically a lot of things appear to me to be, you know, kind of made to be beautiful or made to be design appealing, but they seem on the backside of it to be optimization tricks. Like you hit very nice all the optimization tricks behind basically things that appear to be, you know, just done in an artist way. It's very interesting.
Well, that's, you know, every good design idea is doing three things.
It's just three. What are those three?
So
yeah. What are they? What are they?
You can't just say that.
Multiple things. So the portals, for instance, the portals are good because, say with Liz's spaceship, it's also really big. Right, so you can't put this big spaceship in a room like you can put, this picture of a boat over here that's behind us. So the portal lets you give a window into things that wouldn't fit in a normal gallery. It also solves an optimization problem, and it also gives you that kind of like nice kick of something you can't do in real life. I actually think the portals are really interesting. We talked a little bit about how the gallery is a normal. Kind of a calm place, you know, white walls. It's not crazy. Don't worry, things will be fucking nuts. But in here, you know, you're grounded. You don't have to be afraid. You know how the rules work. But portals, for some reason, seem to be both strange and unreal and grounded in reality. Like they seem normal. People like understand how they work right away. I wonder if it has something to do with how like a normal doorway maybe. Some part of our brain thinks of that as more of a portal than it like really is. Like not consciously we understand what happens when we go through a doorway. We go from, you know, one place to another. But I wonder if some part right deep in our brain is just like they're like this magical thing where so like when you do have a magical liminal. Portal, it seems like a more normal thing than it should.
Yeah. Liminal spaces sort of that we accept as things between things.
Right.
There's also a strange feeling of time. So I usually have a better understanding of how much time we already spent in VR and talked during our normal episodes. But here I am really lost. I don't know if we talked for 5 minutes or 30 or 40 minutes. It's like time is floating by.
We're not even moving around. We're all just staying in one room. Yeah. If we were like checking out the rest of the gallery, you would really get lost.
Yeah,
at a certain we used to give full tours all the time, and they started to take longer and longer until now it's up to like 3 hours, and it's pretty serious. Yeah, it's long.
So how does it all work? You do like every month a party here inside, and in between special people can join, or do you have like those guided tours? So how does it so structure wise work out?
We have a large network of artists and also industry professionals who are enthusiastic about the medium. And that's just kind of been snowballing on both sides. So the audience has been snowballing, but also the number of really awesome artists we're getting to work with is snowballing as well, which is very cool. So I think it's kind of cool. You get the opportunity to tell stories that aren't really being told. You know, they might be hidden away on someone's website, as Colin says, with all of Khabibo's crazy cool experiments. You can kind of bring them out and package them in a way that everyone can enjoy. And I mean, there's so much cool stuff out there, so it's been really cool to see that grow and grow.
Currently we're closed to the public, as you mentioned. We're working towards a release, which I keep saying a year. I don't know. We're working towards a release. Currently, we do a party every month where we add a new exhibit. So we'll open typically one new room. We'll work with one artist to do kind of a focus on their work. And then we'll do a party that, as Robin says, we have kind of a short guest list of people who work in VR and artists who work in VR.
I do want to mention that, especially early on in the podcast history, we mentioned and referred to your GDC talk, I think from 2016 or 2017, about menus suck in VR.
Right, yeah. It was supposed to be called Fuck Menus, but GDC didn't let me call it Fuck Menus.
I love it. I think you touched on so many interesting ideas that are still very much relevant today, and we still see people perhaps not violating those rules, but not thinking through a little bit on their design. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that again. You had an idea that you implemented into Fantastic Contraption in terms of the menu being, or rather than, you know, pressing a button and going to a menu, you put on a space helmet to go into what exactly?
So yeah, in Fantastic Contraption, we have this problem of in Fantastic Contraption, you is a VR game where you make contraptions, so you build things. So you need to be able to save the things you build and then be able to load them later in case you're working on it. So this brought up the problem of how do you do a save load system in VR? We started with like a menu, but VR is such a spatial medium. And humans are so spatial. Nope. You know, if you think about how we interact with the world and how we've used tools, for basically all of time, those have been three-dimensional tools that we pick up and we interact with. And it's only kind of in the last 50, 70 years that things have become buttons and abstracted away. So we've got 10,000 years of history of looking at a tool and guessing what it was for, and then applying it. And so now in VR, we can finally kind of start to move back to that, because tools can't, you know, you don't have that cost of having to build a whole tool and store it somewhere and have a thin usage. You can start to go back to, you can have this big complicated thing. It doesn't cost anything to build it bigger. It doesn't take up any more space in the world. All you need is really clever design. And so you can start going backwards and making tools that are physical. So in Contraption, the way we did that for the save load system is we just had a table. You would kind of activate the save load system by taking a helmet and then putting it over your head. And through the helmet, you saw a different world. You saw this kind of dark world. The normal contraption world is very sunny and green, and this one is kind of like it's night and it's subdued. And there would be a model of the level that you were just on, and then a model of a contraption that you had just built. And so it had like a little base, and it was clear you could like pick it up. And then on the side, we just had a table. And if you wanted to save your contraption, you just pick it up and put it on the table. And then tomorrow you came back, and it would be in the same place. So these ideas of we can like break away from these kind of like boring abstract menus and go to more like concrete ways of looking at the world and interacting with it. So, obviously we're trying to do the same thing in the Museum of Other Realities. We do have some flat menus right now because because it's still early, but we're looking forward to getting all of those, into side of VR. So right now we have very simple avatars because, I like abstract avatars more than other ways of doing avatars, but we do let you choose a couple colors for them. So we'll be looking at how you do that, how you apply colors. Some other people who have done interesting stuff with how you set avatar settings, interacting with a picture, putting things on your face.
There's a few things I'd like to point out that I've noticed in the more. One of which is the camera system, where you don't pull up a menu to find a camera and then there's a camera in the scene. The way you take pictures and selfies are actually, if you imagine in real life, when you stick your thumb and your index finger out, you create this V. And if you do that with both hands, you know, you have that classic director looking like, oh, I want to frame the shot. You literally do that with your fingers in VR, and then you press any button and it takes a photo. That is such an interesting way of doing it, and I haven't seen anyone else do it. Was that another one of these, sitting around, or perhaps one of the artists was like, you know what would be really cool to do? And if you flip your hands, Peter, you do a selfie. So forward facing is outwards, and then if you flip your hands, you can take a selfie.
It's gorgeous.
You can also zoom now with the thumb pad. If you put your thumb on the thumb pad, it'll zoom in and out now. Yeah, so that was somebody's idea at a party. As Robin said, a lot of these ideas aren't ours. it's part of the constantly experimenting and trying things. And so we have a very simple, some people's approach to hands in VR are kind of those like hand puppetry ideas. So you would pull the trigger and then that would close one finger, and then you hold the grips and that would make a fist, or you push down the touchpad and then that gives you a thumbs up. And I am not into this finger puppetry stuff. I think it's, I mean, maybe if you're, you know, 13 and you were starting to use VR and you're using all this finger puppetry stuff, it would get just like second nature and you would like use hands naturally. But certainly at this stage in VR, it feels so fucking weird to be like, oh, wait, hold on, I'm going to thumbs up. What is the button for that there? And you're like, I'm not thumbs upping, but I am in the thing somehow. And it's like, it feels weird and creepy to me, especially like, it's not what my hand is doing. It's like I have a pretend hand. So for hands, we just have two blocks. And then when you pull the trigger, it just makes a kind of a vaguely pointing gesture, but it's vague enough that it also can be a thumbs up or you can do air quotes. So with this,
turn on the same way.
Yeah. Quotes like that.
So this has a couple of advantages. It's not that, you know, it's well outside of the uncanny valley. It's just your hands are cubes. You make this kind of pointer gesture. You don't have this whole weird hand puppetry thing going on. And also because it's kind of a vague gesture, it gives people, they can use it creatively. So like I say, it could be a thumbs up or it could be a point. So it's more of a playful experience and it's driven by the visitors, by the users, by the players, instead of by the designer. You know, that's something I think about a lot in game design, whereas I'm more interested, a lot of games are, oh shit, look how clever I am. Aren't you lucky to be walking through my world? I like those puzzle games where you're creative and you're the star of the show. So I think everything is better if it's driven by the person who's using it, who's inside with us, rather than the designer. So, one of the nice things about having these kind of abstract hands is that someone was in here, we were at a party, and someone kind of did that director's pose, and they were like, oh shit, you should bring up a camera in here. Like, oh damn, yeah, you're right. So as a designer, this has kind of obvious downsides of discoverability, but you know, this is all stuff we're going to figure out.
There is a certain bit of novelty and surprise, right, by discovering certain certain features that aren't essential to the experience, but add to it.
Exactly. I mean, you don't rely on making photos or making this glass instead of your hand, but if you figure it out or someone shows you, you're super happy. You discovered some magical sneaky thingy.
Do you guys want to talk about the glass?
Yeah, it's nice to try and... Oh, yeah, we could talk about the glass. I guess, just to your point, it's nice to try and layer that functionality so that it's only there when you need it, but it doesn't bother you when you don't need it. And I think particularly for first-time users, if you have too many options, you get distracted by the menu and you don't really focus on the experience. So we keep it as simple as possible.
So the
glasses are...
Yeah, what are these glasses and bottles and things that pop up if you do a certain gesture with your hands, and how do they come about?
Well, it might have been before the first party, but we realized that you can put a Vive wand over a long neck beer bottle. And so since the party day for us is the day we shipped that month, I would bring a beer to the show and just drink it while I was chatting. Yeah. And people would see you with your hand, like very much like a beer bottle. And so then we thought, maybe we'll actually make some glasses. We modeled some up for fun. And now you can actually have a drink while you're drinking your drink.
And
this one is the exact dimensions of a long neck beer bottle in the wand, as a matter of fact. That was its purpose, is to have a sort of one-to-one representation. But yeah, I think that the gallery is kind of like a place like a coffee shop or a bar. In that it's not, neither of those places are really gamified, but they're a place to get together with other people. And, you know, you make your own experience. I don't know if that's really how you describe drinking coffee with someone, but I think it kind of is in terms of social interaction. So we feel that drinks are going to be a part of, I'm sure they already are for many people, but I think that certainly they're going to be more and more a part of social VR in the future.
Yeah, well, it's kind of weirdly paradoxical that I feel like we're trying to drive social conventions in VR. And one of the social conventions we're trying to increase is like use of alcohol. Like we want people, when they go to a party, we want them to bring a drink. Like, you know, I don't, I like to go to parties, and I'm not sober through a lot of parties. I think it adds a lot to have a couple beers, you know, not for everybody, and that's fine. But it's still not people's kind of default expectation when they go to a party in VR that they're going to kind of have a drink in their experience. I think if we had some way to serve people alcohol inside the museum, it would be like, it would double how cool this place is. Trying to kind of like change the social conventions and get people to, you know, like if you want to, if you would in real life, you know, bring a drink.
Right. It's. I think it just adds to the lightheartedness of the experience. I love the philosophy behind it. Where with real art galleries, even though there are a lot of like wine and cheese pairings, right, when you're walking around, but art galleries by default are very much seen as almost an unapproachable, another level of class above you that, you know, you don't know enough about. There's a lot of elitism that's around it. And perhaps with this, what you guys are trying to do is make it a little bit more approachable, not take yourself too seriously. And from what I hear you guys describing is you're not even trying to take ownership of the elements that are here and that you've created. Even, you know, even the room's walls, that the way they're generated, are, you're not trying to take ownership of that. So I think that philosophy really has seeped itself into the design of how you've built this place and the experiences that you can have. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, actually, I have really strong feelings on the way people think about art and interact with art, and what the definition of art is, and I think there's a lot of baggage that is really that stops people from having as good experiences as they could or they should. So Sarah and I really enjoy going to contemporary art galleries, but I don't have an art history degree. I don't really have a background in art. I'm basically running an art gallery by accident. But I do love going into contemporary art galleries. And what I like about contemporary art galleries is walking into a room and seeing something and going, holy shit, that's fucking cool as hell. Oh my God, I can't believe how great that is. You know, I'm not walking into an art gallery and being like, you know, I don't like to look at 17th century impressionism. I think impressionism was after the 17th century, so that doesn't even exist. But like, it's, I've seen these pictures before. I'm sure it was very exciting 200 years ago, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
But like, our society has learned all the lessons from that already. We've like engorged all of that art. It's everywhere around me. It's just like a part of my world since I grew up. But you look at something made, there's a lot of people doing contemporary art made for, just designed to like blow your head off right now, that you walk into a room and go like, holy shit, that's fucking amazing. And people, since they're so used to, when you think about art and like, first, it's often this whole other category, which is complete fucking bullshit. There's like no such thing as art. It's like high art and low art and like fuck all of that nonsense. But since people like think about these, when they think about art, and contemporary art is like super looped into art, it's like considered, you know, even more unapproachable than art, even like higher brow than like art possibly. They don't, when they walk into a gallery, they're kind of expecting to have this like, oh wow, you know, it's like that was made in this century and it's important because of this brushstroke and the like what was happening politically at the time. And it's like, no dude, there's a bunch of shit. If like you didn't have that kind of, if that preconception of what art is wasn't like driven into you for your entire life, you could just walk into a place and go like, that's fucking cool as shit, and that's why it's good.
Right,
like it's good because you like it. So the more we're really trying to embrace that, like, it's good because you like it approach to art. So I think we haven't had anybody come in here and go, you know, be intimidated or think it was too highbrow, or vice versa. You know, we've had people from the art world come in here, and like people from the actual art world are looking for the same thing. They're looking for things that like knock their socks off, just like we are. So I think this is successful to a wide variety of people, and I really hope that we can kind of not have people in potential people that will come in be kind of like off put by that kind of like a social highbrow idea of like, oh, I'm going to be, you know, intimidated by this space, or, you know, art isn't a thing I like. I'm more into, you know, like movies and, you know, cool stuff on Pinterest and like, that's what this is. It's like, this is, it's like pop art. If you have to give it a label, it's just fucking cool. It's cool as shit. Like, you should come check it out. It's amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And from the perspective of a cognitive scientist, I always think of art as something that comes out of the necessity of the artist to express himself. But because language and, you know, letters and just, you know, the normal way of communication are not necessarily as good in basically sharing complex ideas, complex feelings, emotions, this necessity to actually share something out of yourself, not necessarily with someone, but express yourself, right? That actually goes into an art. And when I look around here, also very different pieces of art, but they all resemble that in a way artists discovered VR. And they want to, you know, express their love for VR, I guess, but also their internal necessity for certain feelings and emotions. That's why these art pieces are so different, right? And this is something, when you see it and you perceive what the artist actually wanted to express, right, his message, then you will, well, most likely, you should be, like, you know, blown away. So it's not about just being, you know, super fancy or, you know, super colorful, but I think something that makes all the things that I see right now around me so special is that they're not just looking good, they're not just, you know, designed well, they're not just, you know, popping out, but they actually seem to resemble some kind of piece of a soul of this artist, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I like to think of art as part of a larger bag that is cultural production. You know what I mean? And I might not be the best example because I do enjoy like highbrow and lowbrow and all kinds of art, particularly when I read the artist's statement or when I see why something was as prominent as it was. Usually it's for a reason around, you know, the story in that time period, the story of the culture of the people who were there. And I think that, you know, all of that art is cultural production. And the really interesting thing about this sort of new stuff, you could say it's pretty niche at this point, is that I think right now all of these artists too are they're producing that culture. And I hope that, you know, in 100 years or whatever, people can look back to, you know, Danny Bittman's LSD Crab or whatever and look at how it was a reflection of what was going on at the time with the technology. Yes. And the society. Yeah. And
it's also,
I think that's
it's also exciting. A reflection of the tools that were available at the time. And it's interesting to see with certain artists, like timelines, how their art evolves according to their tools, and not even just the mastery of the tools, but what is available to them. And I think with VR, it's even more apparent with, you know, like the there's new apps that are being added. There's completely new features, or the how Tilt Brush even works changes. So that's interesting to see, even in Danny's room, starting with, I don't know where that original corner wall is now, but from that to,
oh yeah, corner vision.
Yeah.
Over there.
How to make it timeless? So, I mean, in a way, when I go right now to the Museum of Van Gogh, right, in Amsterdam, I mean, it's pretty old paintings and they're being taken care of. So I guess we are right now on some kind of digital server all together, and those are those masterpieces. And in a way that you collected them here is already better than having them on some weird Dropbox links that will die off. But have you ever, like, and it's obvious that you can't answer it right now, but have you considered long-term possibilities for maintaining this or making this actually, you know, not fade away with technology changing in a way that something that is on a, you know, VHS disc or whatever, it's like basically not readable anymore. So how can we make this not disappear inside, you know, this big digital void?
Gotta hope GitHub doesn't go down anytime soon. I mean, you have a problem there with any sort of electronic media. It's a lot harder with like physical electronic art, because a lot of those pieces will break down and they're almost irreplaceable. The same issue exists with digital art. I think part, you know, the one feather we have in our cap is that this is on the cloud. So I guess we could hope that as long as Steam remains an institution, this museum will be available.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that turns into over time, you've got to hope that there's going to be some way to continue to present the source that we have here in a way that people can consume, you know, for 100 years. But I think that there's a lot of interesting issues around maintaining digital artifacts that are only beginning to become apparent, and only and we haven't even begun to answer them.
I mean,
we're hardly through the first generation of digital stuff that's going bad.
Absolutely. We had this episode with SciArc, right, where they basically took 3D scans of heritage or cultural heritage that is like flat or actually in 2D. No, it's in 3D in the real world, and they actually were digitizing it, right, and trying to maintain it. But here we literally have already something that is digital. And in a way, it's like the next step.
Mm-hmm. It also opens up the question of, and I kind of want to get you guys' thoughts on this, as to currently art, there's so much art that actually goes, that gets sold. And it is obviously a value. It's a way of, you know, it's an asset. It's a way of holding value and appreciating in value. And a lot of art actually doesn't even get shown in any galleries or even private galleries. They're only kept in these like art. What are they called? There's a great podcast I listened to recently, but that there are these special zones with warehouses that have hundreds and thousands of pieces of art that are in this controlled environment with air conditioning. That, you know, basically what happens is their ownership gets sold back and forth without the art piece itself moving. So there's no tax things they need to worry about. And it's interesting, right? And you can also make an argument that, you know, that's a terrible thing for art, because nobody gets to see it or experience it, and therefore its true value is lost. On the other hand, you know, you can make an argument that, you know, whatever, it's an asset at that point, and don't worry yourself about something that you're already not experiencing. So the point I'm trying to make, or the question I'm asking, is a month or two when we were having an exhibit with John Orion Young was the first one to introduce this concept of using Ethereum to put value on each one of his pieces. And every time, and there's a way of actually buying that piece, which doubles its value. And then if it gets sold again, then you get your money back and you get the double of that. The value doubles basically every time it's sold. And the artist takes, I think, 10%, or maybe it's not even 10%, maybe it's under that. And every time a transaction happens, and it's in a way, it puts intrinsic value on a 3D, you know, data form that is all super hard to actually assign any kind of monetary value, because it's abundant, or it can be replicated. So, I mean, is that so? What do you guys think about that idea? It's such a hard question to answer in terms of digital art and the money side of things.
I mean, I think
that's, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I have very much thoughts on the kind of digital and scarcity. Obviously, it's easy to say like, oh, well, it's infinitely replicatable, so you can't sell it. But, you know, my wife and I made video games professionally for 10 years, and that's infinitely replicable. So I can't pretend like you can't introduce scarcity and then charge money for it digitally, because both games, we like literally do that. But I think it is a lot harder to do that for something like Danny Bittman's LSD Crab. I don't totally have my head around why that's true. Maybe part of that is,
I think it touches on the question of like, what is ownership? What does ownership mean? You could argue that those people that own those pictures in that locked away in that warehouse somewhere, the picture might be gone, or it might be a fake. We don't even know. What they own is the ownership of it. And I think that the idea that I can take a picture of the Mona Lisa, or I can paint an excellent forgery of the Mona Lisa, but it's not the Mona Lisa, is touching on the idea that I can have another copy of LSD Crab, but it's not the copy. Or it's not even about the copy. It's about the idea of LSD Crab itself and whoever. Go ahead.
But you still need some kind of way. I mean, you mentioned basically Ethereum, so it's blockchain. And I mean, I'm usually skeptical regarding blockchain in many contexts. But when you speak about art, or basically making sure that this is that copy, I mean, it's basically with Bitcoin, right? One Bitcoin, you can copy kind of the file, but you're not owning it because you're not being proved by, you know, this long chain of the blockchains that you're owning it. So in a way, there needs to be some kind of, you know, you can copy the crab, you can look at it, you can basically, I could literally walk right now around this crab and make all the time pictures, put it in photogrammetry software and actually recreate it, right? It would be not the same crab. And in a way, if I could, you know, own this crab and actually prove digitally through cryptography, this is my crab, well, I guess a lot of people would be interested in that because it seems to be that people also buy very expensive paintings for whatever reason. So
I think, I think it's the idea of ownership, like who owns it on the public ledger or even the private ledger. If you look at cosmetic items in a lot of video games, they have no effect on the gameplay and they're easily replicable. Mm. Outside the game, but people still buy them. And when they buy a cosmetic item in a game, they're not buying the item itself so much as they are making an investment in the platform and what the platform means to them.
Yes.
Because being seen there with a fancy hat is worth $20. So it might be that being seen here as the owner of LSD Crab, the one and only that Danny himself has anointed because he paid Danny directly, might be very valuable to that person.
Yes.
And all that's transferring, all that's changing hands there is the ownership. And I think what people forget with this argument about, you know, is it physical? Can I duplicate it? Is that the vast majority of things that people own these days are not in their hands. They aren't tangible. You know, it could be said that the bank owns all the funds you have in it. You have access to it because the bank says so. So, you know, those authorities that we accept as real are going to change. And I think the blockchain has already, it's already kind of presented itself as an authority, a new type of authority.
Absolutely. But I guess it also has a huge, go ahead.
This is actually a pretty good segue. You guys are in the experimental build. You guys are in the new one. Okay, well, come over here. Let's go over to Liz's mountain. So
for
you can
the
see this
audio listening people, we are teleporting around.
So you can see this little plaque down here.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Cool.
So this is something, this is currently an experiment that we're just starting with. So this isn't like a huge idea. We don't sure this is gonna work, but it's something we want to play with. And it's exactly what we were just talking about. So so we're standing in front of Liz Edwards' mountains, and so it's a mountainscape. It's got a lake in it. It's got a cabin in it. It's really popular with people who come in because there's a lot to explore. You can go in the cabin. It's a nice place to hang out. So on just beside it here is a plaque that says, "From the personal collection of Alex Schwartz." Alex Schwartz is the CEO of Alchemy Labs, who did JobSim. So with a couple of pieces this month, we're experimenting with this idea of having somebody who owns it only in the more, or a collector who has collected it. So just as we talked about having a public ledger of ownership, I think maybe there's some kind of possibility that the more can become that. And so to get Sir Alex to get his plaque here, he paid Liz an amount of money. And so the more we don't take a cut of that or anything. We just let people support the artists, and then we kind of want that to continue and potentially become a way that artists can be supported for their work. So I think it's an interesting experiment. I think there's a chance that it could work. It could become a way for people to support artists that they like, for artists to get another way of income. We also have. We're okay with the idea, or I guess we support the idea of it becoming potentially a market. So we have, when you buy a piece in the more, we have you agree that you can resell the rights. So say as you could buy it from Alex. But if you do, you have to split the profits with the artist. So instead of having this like strange art market where it's just kind of rich people hedging money and getting tax write-offs, the artist is out of the picture, then you're like always paying the artist, and you have to split 50-50 any profits you make with the artist. So it's a thing we're trying. I mean, it's, you know, as I said before, exploration and trying new ideas is the only way you find good ones. So we're not sure this is a good idea yet, but maybe it'll turn into something.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think this is the public place that you get to like the ownership is shown off, or for the lack of better terms, like the hats of TF2 are here, right? This is your public space that you get to
Maybe one more thing we should add to this part is you guys were also experimenting with donations as well. Is that any another form of monetization that artists can perhaps, or you're experimenting with, and that doesn't really include ownership, but it's more of like, I like this thing, I want this person that made this thing to feel better about themselves, so I'm going to throw them a dollar or two? Or how does that work?
Yeah, so
there will be tiers of cosmetic items available each month as part of the exhibit. We're going to work with artists to produce those items, and then by donating a certain amount, you will get a certain cosmetic to keep with you on your avatar. And it could be a little dragon or a floating jellyfish or a brooch or a hat. And these things you can wear with you to future exhibits just as a memory of your time there.
Nice. I like that. Yeah, real hats. Talking about.
Yeah, literal, virtual, some kind of a hat.
Hats are...
I think that's the best analogy. Right.
If there are aspiring artists out there, and you know, that are listening, a lot of our audience are virtual reality developers and hardcore consumers that do use a lot of these VR tools. I mean, I guess how can they get your attention? Or I'm guessing, is there any kind of formal like process for to apply and to have an exhibit, or is it more of like post your stuff, and if it's cool and you guys see it, it's might get up on your list?
Well, you can go to museumor.com, which is our really bare bones website, and there's some contact information there. We're always looking for new artists, for sure, to join the community. We don't have a ton of capacity to say yes to people right now. We only show about 4 new things a month. We're hoping in the future to be able to say yes to more people to change things around so that we can engage with the community in a more effective way, in a bigger way. So I'm sorry if we don't have space, but definitely get in touch.
Yeah, I think you guys are always looking and finding new people online, and
definitely yes,
trying to figure out.
I mean, there is so much happening, right? I mean, there are so many great VR, AR, XR artists out there that now even I, who am not necessarily doing anything with art, just meet on a lot of events, and I'm like blown away by what they're doing. So yeah, I guess it's a very still small but a very strong growing community, right?
I mean, the reason the museum works and the reason people react so strongly to it whenever we put people in it is the art, quality of the artwork. People are doing just amazing work in VR.
Right. And I think this is, it still is one of the best use cases of VR so far. It's both the creation of art and also the experience of that art is just, it's still a magical experience after or 2 or 3 years, and it just keeps getting better and more advanced. And not that the art that was created in the beginning wasn't as good as it is now. I think it's evolved in different ways.
Yeah, I agree.
Cool. Any final thoughts, you guys, on art or design?
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for.
No, I appreciate it, guys.
Yeah, thanks for allowing us to sneak inside this wonderful place and to share the insights of it.
Yeah,
with our audience.
We're excited for the public launch of this, so that you know people that are listening can come in and meet you guys, meet us, and meet the other artists that have contributed. Yeah.
Is there a way how people can support you, by the way? So let's say there's someone who's listening who's like, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, they could get in touch with us.
Yeah.
Oh,
mail money.
Send money too.
Just mail money.
Somebody
guys.
Out there is very rich and they're interested in supporting the arts. Definitely get in touch.
Yeah. So anyone listening,
grants or
definitely
investment or whatever you're into.
We can put your name on a wall.
And
there's really a lot of beautiful walls here. I mean, if I would have money, I would totally buy one of those walls.
That's a good looking polygon right over there.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I mean, those shapes and the light. Whoa. Yeah. I mean,
it's more than your typical quad.
You know what's actually hilarious is that the wall in the back, the Gerard wall from Armenia, is literally a wall made of art built for people that have donated money to the monastery to keep it alive.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Those are like dedication art pieces that, like, you know, artists have sit there and inscribed and carved out into the mountain as like, oh, thank you for serving the monastery or helping the monastery. And like, yeah, maybe there's even a greater metaphor here for people wanting to support the sphere itself. Cool. And if you guys have, or not you guys, but if the listeners have extra money that they would like to help the arts and or help the podcast, we do have a Patreon page now, and we would love and support anyone that is willing to help us keep the show alive. And cool. Do you guys want to throw your Twitter handles out?
I'm just at Colin Northway.
Cool. And Robin?
And I'm at Robin Stethem.
Awesome. And
which is going to be very hard to spell, so you'll probably have to refer to the podcast.
It will be in the...
No one can spell Stethem right.
Stethem-Robyn.
That's right.
I-N. R-O-B-I-N.
Oh, okay.
And we are at the Research VR, at the Research VR Cast on Twitter, and at the Research VR Podcast on Facebook, but we don't care about Facebook. I don't know why I keep mentioning it.
I do care about Facebook sometimes.
Yeah, you're way more active on it than I am. I've almost completely been off that. What else? We do have a YouTube channel now where we are starting to post some highlights. Yes. Not the whole thing, but if we have like video or highlights, we will post that. And I think we might post some, maybe a highlight clip or two from this podcast as well. So thank you again, Colin and Robin, for joining us. This has been a really fun conversation. And see you guys next time.